patients. More at MakingCancerHistory.com.
Support for WNF comes from our members of Live Nation, presenting OAR with special guests American Authors and Hunter Tones. June 19th at Mahaffey Theater in St. Petersburg. Get more info at themahaffey.com.
Walks like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal, come hear the animals, talking animal, talking animal.
Good morning. This is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss, and my guest today is St. Petersburg Mayor Rick Kreisman, who about a year ago signed a proclamation declaring St. Petersburg a pet-friendly city. St. Pete has since unfurled an initiative called St. Pete Paws that puts that proclamation into action. There are multiple objectives involved here, not least reducing pet homelessness in the city. The initiative also seeks to cultivate responsible pet ownership amidst other goals, which Mayor Kreisman can surely explain far better than I can. But he's clearly an animal guy, including that he and his family are puppy raisers for Southeastern Guide Dogs. Meanwhile, St. Pete's status as a pet-friendly city and the related initiative hook into an art exhibit entitled Woof, Meow, Chirp, and Slither, Artists Interpret the World of Pets. This exhibit opened last week at Florida Craft Art and is on view there through August 10th. I'll speak with Mayor Kreisman in a few moments here on Talking Animals on WMNF, and that interview will be streaming on Facebook Live. In fact, we're already streaming live. If you want to check it out, it's on my personal page, Duncan Strauss, on Facebook. Later in the program, I'll speak with Dr. Jennifer Conrad, veterinarian and founder of the Paw Project, which played a pivotal role in the momentous news last week that New York lawmakers had passed a ban on declawing cats. If Governor Cuomo signs the bill, New York will become the first state in the country to outlaw the procedure. If you've tracked the issue for a few years, you know that nothing of consequence gets done legislatively to ban cat declaw surgery without Dr. Conrad. I first entered her about this in 2005, and I look forward to speaking with her again later in the show. Meanwhile, a reminder that WNF's Summer Fun Drive starts 1 week from tomorrow. I've been assigned a fundraising goal of $3,000, which is fairly insane for an hour-long show. I'll need to generate donations before my fund drive show, so I hope you'll consider making an early pledge to support Talking Animals and me, which you can arrange by emailing me at duncan@wmnf.org. As always, we'll have exceptional thank you gifts exclusive to Talking Animals, including a pair of amazing tickets to see Queen at Amalie Arena. That show is effectively sold out. Last I looked, single tickets, which is all that's left, had a minimum price of $971. So for the right pledge, we have a pair together in section 117, row K. Great, great seats. So to check out all the thank you gifts, including our great Royal Blue Talking Animals t-shirt, visit our website, talkinganimals.net. Right now, though, let's get to Mayor Kreisman with a reminder that I invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj@wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. This is Mayor Rick Kreisman on WMNF on Talking Animals. Good morning, Mayor Kreisman.
Good morning, Duncan.
I guess my first question is, what's the mayor of St. Petersburg doing on an obscure little animal radio show?
Anytime I have an opportunity to talk about St. Petersburg and something great that I think that we're doing in St. Pete, I'm always going to take advantage of that, and I certainly appreciate the opportunity to be on your show and talk a little bit about what we're doing in St. Petersburg and why it's such a great city, not just for two-legged people, but for four-leggeds.
Yeah, that's what I hear. So our conversation today may well reflect the best version of the expression, the personal is political. As I noted near the top of the show, your family has served as puppy raisers for Southeastern Guide Dogs, and I want to circle back to that in a few minutes. But first, I'd like to just get more of your history in this regard. When did animals first become important to you?
Well, I've my whole life, really, I've grown up with dogs, although there was a point in time where I did have a cat. So
that sounds like sort of an anomaly.
it was a little bit.
Yeah.
I'm more of a dog person, but you know, I think that the various dogs that we've had over the years have been such an important part of my life and of our family's life, and you know, have left such an impact and great memories that, you know, being translating that into some of the work that I do as mayor, it just seems kind of natural.
Sure. So, did you grow up in a family with lots of pets from the get go? I mean, is that
we didn't have more than one. We always had one dog, although. My wife and I and our kids now, I think the most we've had in the house at one time was four.
Wow.
Which is a handful.
That's a full house.
A full house.
Yeah.
Two is a lot more manageable. I actually really like having two dogs, and we have two now.
Okay. So they can keep each other company, but it's not as nutso as four.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So looking back, would you say when you were growing up, what was your family's sort of prevailing attitude about animals? What did you sort of get or learn from early on, those formative years?
You know, I think as a lot of people that are animal lovers know, there's no judgment. You know, you come home, whether it's from school or from work, wherever you're coming from, you walk in that door, and there's that dog or cat or whatever animal you have to greet you, and act as if they hadn't seen you in years, and all they want to do is just show you affection and love you, and it doesn't matter how bad your day is, all of a sudden the day's not so bad.
Yeah. Not a bad way to be greeted.
Yeah.
Yeah. So fast forwarding a bit then, describe how you and your family did become puppy raisers.
So it really started with my daughter. We had been down to Southeastern Guide Dogs to do something called puppy hugging, which is where you got to go down there. A group sat in a big circle on the floor in this one room, and then they opened the doors, and in would roll these 10 to 15 puppies that were, you know, 5-6 weeks old that you got to play with.
Wow.
Which was just...
How did you ever leave?
They had to be pretty strict with us because nobody would have left.
Time's up.
That's right.
Right. Yeah.
So it was just a bit of heaven. And when my daughter turned 13, she was going to be bat mitzvahed and had to do a service project for the temple. And we said to her, what do you want to do for your service project? And she said, I want to be a Southeastern Guide Dog puppy raiser.
Wow.
So we started exploring it. That was a big responsibility for her to take on. And we knew that, you know, it would probably be a little bit more than what she could handle. It would be more of a family thing. But we said, okay. And we got our first guide dog puppy to raise. And his name was Jim. We got him when he was about 12 weeks old. And we had him till he was about 14 months old. And at that point in time, they do what's called IFT, or in for training, where they go back to Southeastern to their campus for the next 6 months. They get examined, physically checked out. They go through training. They test their dispositions. And if they're a candidate to be matched, then they will try and match that dog up with someone who's got a visual impairment. In this case, Jim did get matched.
Mm.
And only about 40% of the dogs that go through training actually make it, whether it's a physical issue or, you know, they may be otherwise dog distracted or food distracted or something that would prevent them from being a good guide dog candidate that causes them to not be able to finish the program. But in this case, Jim made it. He got matched, and we got to meet the person he was matched with, and they're still together. It's a great story.
That's very cool. Now, I think there's been quite a few puppies that your family has raised since then.
Yes, we just finished with number 10.
Wow. Do you get some sort of plaque or a ribbon or something when you hit the 10 level?
Yeah, they do a special recognition for you.
Cool.
Southeastern is really great because they know that, you know, they rely on volunteers. They don't charge for the dogs. They give them to the people who are getting them.
Yeah.
Each dog that makes it through the program, they figure they've got about $60,000 invested.
Yeah.
And so they know that for puppy raisers, you become, obviously, after spending a year with a dog, you get a little emotionally attached.
Yeah.
And so they do, you know, they really recognize us in a really nice way. They bring us all in for IFT Day. There's a big celebration. When you say goodbye to your dog, you get a plaque recognizing your commitment and what you've done. And then if your dog makes it, you come back in for puppy, what they call puppy raiser day, where you get to see the dog again. And typically at that point, you haven't seen that dog for at least 6 to 7, 8 months.
Mm.
And you get to meet the person they've been matched with and learn a little bit about them. It's pretty emotional.
Yeah. And do you find that for you and your family that it just seems like, as you kind of alluded to, that you spend that kind of time, 14 months thereabouts, with the dog, and then it's like, okay, back to Southeastern. I mean, it's got to be a tug. But at this point, now that you're 10 dogs in, I guess, have you gotten better at it? Is there still a tug, the same one that it was with Jim when you handed him over?
Every time you take a dog back, there's always tears because these dogs are just amazing, and you really form this bond with the dog.
Yeah.
And the question I get asked more than anything else when it comes to raising puppies is, how do you give them up? How do you go back there after a year with that dog and turn that dog in? So I tell the story of Jim. And when we met the lady he was matched with, she told us a story of how for her entire life she had been blind and she always walked with a cane. And she said to us, you know, when I walk with a cane, my head is down because I'm listening to the sounds that the cane is making as I'm walking. She said, and as she's telling us this, tears start coming down her face. Mm-hmm. And it's hard not to get emotional.
Yeah.
And she said, now that I have my Jim, I can walk with my head held high.
Oh, wow.
And so we all kind of looked at each other and we go, okay, we can do this.
Jeez, there could be a bunch of tears here in the WNF studio if you keep this up.
Sorry about that. Christ,
but no, but because I also thought about, especially with Jim, that since this was prompted really by your daughter saying, hey, this would be a cool project, I would also think that as tough as it is generally, that if you're a 13 or 14-year-old girl saying goodbye to someone that spent like a year plus in the house, it makes it even way tougher.
It does. And the dog lived in her room. Mm-hmm. And she really, you know, I give her a lot of credit. She really took lead on raising that guide dog and training, because there are some basic training skills that as puppy raisers we are obligated to teach the dog, and we also go to regular meetings that they have with all the puppy raisers where, you know, we get tips on how to train them better, and they check and see how the dog is progressing. And it was pretty tough on her. She's a great kid, and she gets real emotional. The whole family does. So my son would probably hate me saying that he gets emotional about it, but he does too.
Oh, Dad.
It's pretty hard for you not to.
Yeah. But great that you keep doing it. And, I want to come back in just one sec to a couple of the dogs that have remained in the Kreisman household. But this is Talking Animals on WNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. If you just tuned in, my guest is St. Petersburg Mayor Rick Kreisman. We'll talk about some city sort of policies and St. Pete paws and all kinds of other things. Right now we're talking about that their family are puppy raisers for Southeastern Guide Dogs. This conversation also sort of ties into an exhibit called Woof, Meow, Chirp, and Slither, Artists Interpret the World of Pets, that opened last week at Florida Craft Art and is on view there through August 10th. If you'd like to ask Mayor Kreisman a question or offer a comment, please call 813-239-9663. Email DJ at WMNF.org or text 813-433-0885. And if you did just join us, then let me tell you that we are also streaming this conversation on Facebook Live via my personal page, Duncan Strauss. So tell us about a couple of dogs that, not the protocol, but ended up remaining, with your family.
Yeah. So, we raised this one dog. I think she was, Christy, I think was number 8 or 9. And she was an amazing dog. I mean, they're all wonderful dogs. Some of them tug at you a little harder, just because of their disposition. They're just so loving and sweet. She was one of those. So when we took her in for training, that one was a hard one, but we also thought she's going to make an amazing guide dog for somebody. And she was pretty close to the end of her training, and they were getting ready to match her with someone when she was out playing with some of the other dogs, and a freak accident tore her ACL.
Wow.
So they notified us of what had happened. They said, we're going to do surgery on her. She's going to need to rehab. Would you guys be willing to take her back and rehab her? We said, of course we would. So they did the surgery. We took her back. We did the rehab with her. And then they ultimately decided they didn't want to take a chance that if she tore one ACL, she might be prone to tearing another one. Mm. And so they decided that they were going to take her out of the program. Now, when that happens, sometimes they will do something called career change, where the dog could become a PTSD dog. It could be a Gold Star dog. It could be a drug sniffer or bomb sniffing dog. In this case, they decided not to career change Christy. And so they always, if they don't career change and the dog isn't making it, they offer the dog first to the puppy raiser. And then if not the puppy raiser, then they put the dog up for adoption. We jumped at the chance to adopt Christy. And sure. So she's living with us and has been for the last couple of years. She serves as an ambassador for their program. But she just turned 4 years old. And
that's
then
great.
Dog number 10, our most recent dog, his name was Jake. And he is another little special guy. But we noticed something didn't seem right physically with him. And so we took him back to Southeastern to their vet. He examined him, decided he needed to be seen by a specialist. And ultimately, they had a neurologist that did an MRI on Jake, and they discovered he had a neurological disorder in his brain. And as a result of that, they said he cannot continue in the program. And we went ahead and we adopted Jake also.
And as far as, I think we just spoke a little bit before on the air, but Jake is otherwise fine, right? He's just not able to continue in the program, but he seems like suffering no ill effects, at least at the moment.
He's a really smart dog. We see the neurological disconnect sometimes in with his hind legs. Mm. Sometimes they slide out on him, and he also doesn't always sense when he needs to relieve himself.
Okay.
And
right.
So
so no one's off scot-free here, but at least no. He's in a happy home and you guys still get to hang with Jake.
Yeah, and so, we should buy stock in paper towel companies.
There you go. Okay, well, here's an email question. Actually, you've answered pretty much all of it except of maybe the very last part. What happens to the dogs that don't make it through training? We've covered that. Where do they send them or do they adopt them out? We've kind of covered that. And what is the success rate they say of adoption, but I would be more curious to know what the success rate of placing the dog.
Yeah, it's about 40% of the dogs that go through the training get matched. And for those that don't, they initially will try and career change them, and then if they can't, they adopt them out. And Southeastern does have, you can sign up to get on a list to adopt one of their dogs if you want to. You know, they exist solely on contributions. And again, they don't charge, and so, you know, certainly they have their walkathons in St. Pete and in Tampa and Sarasota and Bradenton. It's really an amazing organization, and their facilities are absolutely first class.
And is that really the only way they generate their funds, Mayor Chrysler? Because I actually have another emailer who was just asking, could you speak a little bit about Southeastern Guide Dogs raises money to keep afloat?
Yeah.
And it is amazing, as this emailer notes, that they invest tens of thousands of dollars in each dog, but that's a lot of money to raise. So is it just those things you just mentioned, or is they have any other kind of grants or any other?
I don't know if they ever apply for grants.
Okay.
I know their primary source of funds, though, is fundraising.
Wow.
And, you know, I've heard stories of other organizations that raise, whether it's a guide dog or a dog that senses when somebody's going to have a seizure, and those organizations charge and quite a bit of money.
Yeah.
They charge the person. That's, to me, is one of the most amazing things about Southeastern, is they don't charge anything.
Yeah.
And the person that gets matched with the dog will live on their campus for like 26 days. All their meals are provided to them. Everything is provided to them. They have beautiful accommodations to start bonding with that dog and gaining confidence in the dog, and the dog gaining confidence in
right,
the person.
Right, kind of under the tutelage of the Southeastern folks. Yeah, no, it's just an amazing program. So, all right, well, I could talk about puppies all day, and I think it's pretty clear that you could too, but also really interested in learning more about your proclamation declaring St. Pete a pet-friendly city and some of the things that have happened in the wake of that. And let me, as ties into that, let me just read yet another emailer. The SP mayor is a huge reason why SP is so wonderful. I have lived here since 1964 and could never have imagined it being as fantastic as it has become. Him being on your show is a great example of his dedication to the city. Thank you, Mayor Kreisman. So that's kind of a nice note.
Whoever that was, thank you so much.
That
that's
was
very
Denise.
Kind. Thank you, Denise.
Denise is. So So what precipitated the proclamation declaring St. Pete a pet-friendly city?
So, you know, in St. Pete, you know, I think we do a great deal of focus on quality of life and trying to create a city where everybody feels welcome. You know, as someone who is a pet owner, I know the impact that pets have on your life and how they add to quality of life. We have a Healthy St. Pete program where we want to become a healthier community. And one of the things that we also know about pets are they reduce blood pressure. They reduce stress. They make people calmer and more at ease and happier. And so it just seemed natural if when you talk about creating a city that has a great quality of life, is welcoming of everyone, to include animals as part of that welcoming of everyone. Because for so many people, their pets are their family. They may not have children, or even if they have children, their pets are just another child in, in their minds, or a brother and a sister to someone. And so, you know, trying to create a community where, you know, our pets are welcome. They feel welcome. People who have pets feel welcome. It's not just good for quality of life, but it's also an economic development tool, and it's an economic driver. People look for those kind of communities where they know that if they're pet lovers, they can come live in that community, and they and their pets can be a good part of that community. So it made sense from a lot of different perspectives.
And how many cities, as far as you know, at least across the country, have the same kind of proclamation in place?
Truthfully, I don't know if anyone else has done this.
Oh, really?
I do know that.
I thought it was rare. I didn't know it was that rare.
Okay. And there may be others that have.
Yeah.
You know, there is an organization, Mars, and they're known in the pet world by Blue Pearl, for example.
Okay.
But the Mars Corporation, and it is a big company, complete with candy bars and everything. They do pet foods.
Yeah.
But they have created a program called Better Cities for Pets. And I actually learned about that program when I was attending a U.S. Conference of Mayors conference, where they had a booth there, and they were encouraging cities to become more pet-friendly and actually apply to become recognized and certified as a better city for pets. And St. Petersburg is in the middle of that process right now.
So what is the criteria to become recognized in that manner?
So our program, our pet-friendly program, is modeled after the better cities so that we could also qualify for that. And there are really 12 traits that really define healthy and happy pets and people and responsible pet ownership. And those traits are kind of grouped into four kind of areas: shelters, homes, parks, and businesses. And so, you know, we look for businesses, for example, and we actually have a sticker and an application that you can fill out. You go online, excuse me, to our St. Pete Paws website, and you can download an application to become a mayor's pet-friendly business. There's a number of things that we're looking for your business. For example, to be a pet-friendly business, we want to ensure that your staff has received pet handling training, basic pet skills, so that, you know, when you come in, when people come in with their pet, there's a comfort level between staff and the pet, that there's insurance, that the business is insured, so everybody feels welcome, that there are behaviors that are expected of both the pet and the owner that are displayed in the business. Because we want to be a pet-friendly business or a city, but we also want pet owners to be responsible. So, for example, that doesn't mean letting your dog run loose without being on a leash. It means being responsible, making sure that your pet is safe and that those around your pet are safe. And so there's a number of different things that we look for our businesses to get certified. And if they do, we'll put us, give them a thing they can put on their window that says that they are a mayor's pet-friendly business. From a housing standpoint, we like to see more rental properties and condos that are open to people having pets in those places.
And that almost inevitably makes me ask, is there any exclusion for any kind of breeds currently for people who do want to rent a home or an apartment?
Some places do, and certainly are. What we're encouraging is to look at those restrictions and roll those back.
Okay, so they're not municipal, they're by that apartment complex
exactly.
or by that landlord.
Exactly.
Okay.
So we want property managers, we want apartment and condo owners to be a little bit more open to people bringing their pets in. You know, I mean, this is somebody's part of somebody's family, and
yeah.
if we don't have a lot of rental properties in our community that allow pets, it makes it hard for us to attract people to come to our community, or for businesses to come here, because they know that their workforce isn't going to have a place to live.
Yeah,
and so again, that goes to the economic piece that I spoke about earlier. It's good business, and it makes sense for the city. So we focus on housing, and parks is another area where, you know, the city already has a number of dog parks, but we're looking to add hydration stations in our parks so that dogs and their dog owners can, you know, make sure their dogs are hydrated. We want to have, bags available so that owners can pick up after their dogs
sure.
if the dog has an accident. So we're looking to do educational signage in our parks. So these are all the type of things that Better Cities for Pets are looking for. As far as issuing certifications, and you know, it's part of again that proclamation that I issued back in 2018 that we want to make sure our pets are well cared for, that their owners are responsible in their ownership, and that we are a city that celebrates that.
Yeah. Let me let folks know again. This is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. My guest is St. Petersburg Mayor Rick Kreisman. We're discussing, among other things, the St. Pete Paws Initiative, the Better Cities for Pets. In a sense, this is a sneak preview also of a talk he'll give tomorrow, if I'm not mistaken, right, at 5:30?
Yes.
At Florida Craft Art, and there's a great exhibit.
Great exhibit.
Yeah.
If you've never been to Florida Craft Art, you should go anyway, even if this exhibit wasn't there. But this is, especially if you're an animal lover, you got to go see this exhibit.
Yeah, it's called Woof, Meow, Chirp, and Slither, Artists Interpret the World of Pets, and just the few pieces I've seen photos of look fantastic. So, anyways, you'll be there at 5:30 tomorrow discussing some of the things we're discussing here, but also people can check out the exhibit. So, meanwhile, if you'd like to join this conversation, please call 813-239-9663, email dj at wmnf.org, or text 813-433-0885. And again, this conversation is streaming on Facebook Live via my personal page, Duncan Strauss, on Facebook. So, one thing that I think was part of this that I'm really interested in is seemed like an important objective was decreasing the homeless population of pets. What sort of measures have you put in place to try to achieve that?
Yeah, you know, it's some of that has to do with being responsible pet owners. You know, one of the things that we're trying to do is educate the public more about pet ownership and what's involved in it. I think a lot of people maybe go into becoming a pet owner with the best of intentions, and just go in not really understanding completely what all is involved in being a pet owner. I mean, it is like having a child. It is a real responsibility. You can't just come and go as you please, because somebody's got to be there to make sure that dog or cat or whatever the animal is has an opportunity to go out and relieve itself, is getting food, is getting attention and being well cared for. And so I think part of the way that you address pet homelessness is you're trying to address it on the front end, and so that you make sure that the people are educated in what they're getting into when they become a pet owner, and so that they're not either abandoning that pet because they just couldn't handle it and it was overwhelmed, or they're taking that pet back to a shelter where they end up overwhelming the shelter with too many pets. So education is a big part of it, and then working with great community partners, and that is also part of our PAWS program. And PAWS, by the way, St. Pete PAWS stands for St. Pete is a pet, the P, friendly city, where pets are welcome, and the A, owners are caring, nurturing guardians, W, working together to provide S, safe and secure environments. And so we've got great collaboration and great partners in this program, from the business community to animal welfare groups to the county to Blue Pearl and the Mars family, and of course the city government itself.
And how do you feel? I know it's kind of pretty early on But how do you feel like it's going relative to when you said, hey, we should do this in St. Pete, what you kind of imagined in your head?
Well, and she's probably going to be mad at me for calling her out, but Susie Ahock on my staff has really been the driving force. You know, I knew that I wasn't going to have the time to dedicate to really getting this program up and running, and an amazing website, by the way, which we encourage you to check out, the St. Pete Paws, where there's tons of information. And so I picked someone to kind of spearhead the program that was on my team, who I knew was also a pet lover. And was passionate about animals. And she took that ball and she ran with it in an amazing way. And really, this great program is really a testament to all of her hard work, because she worked really hard with our partners, that some of whom I mentioned earlier, to really get this program up and running. And I think the more we talk about it, and again, I appreciate the opportunity to talk about the program today on your show.
Sure.
The more people will learn about it and hopefully get involved with it. And hopefully we'll have more and more businesses who will want to sign up to be pet-friendly businesses and display that really cool logo on their windows and let the whole world know, and all of our visitors to our beautiful city know, that they're pet-friendly businesses, or this is a hotel or an apartment that you can rent because it's pet-friendly.
So, Mayor Kreischman, I have a few questions of my own, and there's a few more email or questions that I want to get to in our remaining time. But if I understood you correctly earlier when I asked you, like, how many other cities you thought had this, and you said, as far as I know, we're the first. So is it at least an indirect kind of objective to sort of serve as a model, like say, hey, look what we've done here in St. Pete, and you too could do this if you were so inclined?
Yeah, I mean, I'd love to take full credit for it, but I do think the Myers Corporation and the Better Cities for Pets initiative that I first learned about at U.S. Conference of Mayors really helped convince me that, hey, this is an idea that has a lot of merit. And I suspect there are a number of other cities around the country who are also going through the certification process with Mars right now.
Oh, I see. So it could be a certain time where all of a sudden
there's going to be
a few cities.
I think
pop,
you're going to see them pop all around the country.
Okay, because that makes sense.
You know, that's the beauty of one of the things I really appreciate about the U.S. Conference of Mayors is it's really an opportunity for us to learn about best practices, about programs that we might be interested in bringing to our communities, even if it's a brand new program that no one else is doing yet. You know, it's not having to create the wheel completely ourselves. Again, as I said, you know, Susie and her team and our partners did a great job, because a lot of this they did create on their own, but it was modeled again after the Better Cities for Pets, and it served as a great model for us to use to build our platform.
Yeah. So here's a question from an email. This is actually from Don Goldstein, who for a long time has been our Greyhound correspondent here on Talking Animals, and really was pivotal in helping raise awareness and ultimately get that.
Those are beautiful dogs.
Yeah, and he was really crucial in helping educate our listeners over many years and getting that amendment passed. But anyways, he's asking here, is there any thought to restricting the use of retractable leashes in St. Petersburg?
I have not heard any issues directly related to those, yet. Certainly if there are, issues related to those, I and my team would be interested in learning about it. I hadn't heard anything, so I'm not aware of any, but obviously if he's asking the question, there must be some issues related to those.
Yeah, I think some people feel there are some dangers in just the way they can retract, and they don't retract and they get hung up, and then you got a problem sometimes.
Yeah.
So, okay, so that's something that may be presented further and explored. So here's another email, another Mayor Kreischman. You know, it says, good morning. I've had the opportunity to meet with the mayor in person. I have an immense amount of respect for him and for his stance on inclusiveness. The interview and his compassion for animals only increases my respect for him. Thank you for having him on. So that's from Atik Albi. And then here's something just popped up about dog parks. Does St. Pete have any plans to increase the number and or size of dog parks? From what I understand, there are just 7 in the city.
Typically those dog parks have been built, utilizing WikiWatchy funding. It was administration working in partnership, with city council. And in fact, our first dog park actually was built back when I was on city council. And we brought the idea that we said we want to use WikiWachi funds to do this to the mayor at that time, who had no objections to it. And so we started with the first dog park and kept growing those. And actually, if you if you've ever in St. Pete brought your dog to a dog swim, where we open some of our pools at the end of the season to dogs, that was an idea that I brought to the city also, that when I was on city council, I had read about it, excuse me, taking place in another city. I thought, what a cool idea. Again, talked to our leisure services director at that time and to the mayor at that time and said, hey, this is something I think would be really cool for us to do here in St. Pete. They had no objections. We started it and we're still doing it.
Great. Cool. Well, again, this is Talking Animals on WNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. I'm speaking with the St. Pete Mayor, Rick Kreisman. We're in our final couple minutes, but do have a chance, probably if you jump on it, to get involved in the conversation, ask Mayor Kreisman a question or offer a comment. Please call 813-239-9663, email dj at WNF.org, or text 813-433-0885. And again, we are streaming this conversation on Facebook Live or via my personal page, Duncan Strauss. So here's Mayor Kreisman. Someone was so intent on having this question asked that she emailed it to me on Monday. So basically she says, given that you've declared St. Pete a pet-friendly city and your good work as a guide dog puppy raiser, you and your family, what would it take to pass a ban on wild and exotic animal acts in St. Pete / Pinellas County, like the bans in other great cities like NYC, Los Angeles, Portland, Maine, etc.?
I certainly, I'd be interested in learning more about what the ban is, and taking a look at what some other communities have done. Ultimately, it's a decision that would have to be made by city council, as to whether they would do that. I don't know that, I could do it with an executive order. I'd have to look and see if I could.
Yeah.
You know, I'm always open if somebody has something that they think is a good idea that we ought to consider in St. Pete. I'm always open to listen and to try and learn more about it and see if I think it makes sense for our city.
Yeah.
I think one of the things that I love about St. Pete is we are pretty progressive and unafraid to tackle difficult issues or take on things that might be a bit controversial if we think it makes sense for our community. And, you know, and fortunately, I've got a city council that I think shares a lot of the same feelings that I do. And so we're in lockstep on an awful lot of things that makes it a lot easier.
Yeah. I think this question, of course, was partly born of the way a lot of places, including some that she mentioned, are just concerned about circuses, but other traveling animal acts where the animals are really put through tough conditions, mm-hmm. either A, to be trained to perform or jump through fire or dance or whatever they're doing, and then B, just the conditions usually of traveling around from place to place. So I think that's probably okay. What fueled her question, just because in as animal a friendly place as St. Pete, I think her thought was like, well,
that would be natural.
And
we've taken a stance on puppy mills too in the past.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, because those are the scourge.
They're horrible. But,
yeah. So let's get one question here on. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Mayor Kreisman.
Hey, I wonder, Mayor Kreisman, what do you think is going to happen to Derby Lane ultimately when it closed? What's going to happen with that facility?
Oh, that's a good question. It's privately owned property. I know there was a lot of discussion or conjecture about whether that would be the appropriate place for a new baseball stadium. In my discussions I've had with the Rays, that site's been taken off the table. There are some long-range challenges, I think, with that site just based on sea level rise that would have to be addressed no matter what happens on that site. But, I mean, it's a big piece of property, and I'm sure at some point in time the owners are going to sell it and it'll be redeveloped. What it's redeveloped to be, I don't know. Certainly, I think there's a real opportunity for some housing that's affordable to take place on that site. But we don't own it, so we can't really control what happens.
And do you know when the last race is going to be?
I don't. I think there was, I'm trying to remember what the period was in the legislation that was phasing it out. Was it maybe another year? A lot of what they do now there is also is other kind of gaming with poker and things. And so I don't know if they're going to try and keep that part open while the racing stops or what they're going to do with it.
All right, caller. Thank you. We got to move along. Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. So, Mayor Kreisman, just we have maybe 1 minute or so left, and so one of the emailers just wrote in and says, the State Department of Health does not allow non-ADA animals in bars and restaurants. How will you be able to work around this?
You know, I think it's and restaurants and bars obviously are certainly more challenging because of health. But there are restaurants, for example, that have, and in St. Pete we have a lot of them, that have outdoor cafe seating. I think certainly that's one way to still allow someone with their pet to come and dine at their restaurant or have a drink at their bar, where it doesn't put their license at
in
risk
jeopardy.
At all.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so, you know, this is a continuing dialogue that we're going to be having with the health department and with our partners at workarounds for some of the more challenging issues like this. We're confident that there's solutions that can be had and continue to be, you know, a real business-friendly community for pets.
Gotcha. All right. Well, Mayor Kreisman, I think we have reached the end of our time. We speak with Mayor Rick Kreisman, obviously St. Pete's mayor. The website to find out more about the pause thing is stpete.org/pause.
And I have a gift for you, too, I'm going to give you.
Oh, great. Wow.
Is there some pet shampoo since we're talking about pets?
I my hair probably does look a little dirty.
It's in the family business. Yeah. It's okay. A company called Glomar, but these are
cool.
For you.
All right. Well, thank you kindly. Yeah. We have a dog that manages to roll around and all kinds of things that I won't even mention right now on the air, so these will come in extremely handy, so thank you. So, Mayor Kreisman, thank you so much for coming in and speaking with us on Talking Animals and all your great work on behalf of animals.
Thank you again for having me on. We appreciate it.
All right. In a few moments, I'll speak with Dr. Jennifer Conrad, founder of the Paw Project, which was central to last week's major development, whereby New York looks poised to become the first state to allow the feline declaw procedure. Over the years, to outlaw, I should say, the feline declaw. Over the years, Dr. Conrad and the Paw Project have been involved in a declaw ban of all shapes and sizes. We'll hear a bit about how the New York one came together in a moment. Right now, it's time to step into the comedy corner. This is Greg Fitzsimmons with a piece called Adopting a Dog in today's comedy corner on Talking Animals on WMNF.
So we rescued a puppy, which is great. You've rescued a puppy before. Okay, beautiful. It's a great thing. Millions of dogs are put to sleep every year because there's not enough homes. And you go in and you're a hero. You go save one. You walk in there and you think it's going to be easy. You're like, I'll take that one. They're like, oh, not so fast, asshole. First, you got to fill out this 28-page application. Right? Name, social security number. If you and your wife divorce, who gets custody of the dog? I don't know. We never talked about it. Thanks for planting that seed for us. And then they set up a home inspection. I'm not making this up. Literally, woman shows up to my house. Clipboard, little beard, light beard. Didn't see it at first. And now she's looking around my house while I stand out front waiting. Just nervous that she's going to come out and be like, yeah, we're just going to go ahead and kill the dog. Doesn't feel right to let him live here the way you do. Take him out back and just shoot him. We feel pretty good when we rescue a dog, don't we? Right? We feel like heroes. Meanwhile, there's two types of shelters in the country. There's shelters for dogs, the Humane Society. Shelters for people. Halfway house. Not even a whole house. Half a house. And then we rescue from the other one. We grab a dog, we bring him home, and we wash him, and we fix him. We bring him to bed, we pet him, and we hold him, take him for a walk. And then we walk around a human that's laid out on the sidewalk to pick up from the dog that we rescued. What's wrong with that picture? Why don't we rescue from the other place? Just go in there, I'll take that guy, bring him out. Take him home, give him a steak and a shave, a little corduroy bed in the corner. Come on, Freckles, let's take a walk. It's Dennis. I told you my name's Dennis. Freckles! Come on, let's go outside. Been outside a lot. Kind of want to stay inside for a while. Your friend comes over. He's cute. What is he? I think he's Dutch.
That was Greg Fitzsimmons with a piece called Adopting a Dog, taken from his album Life on Stage. Now let's talk with Dr. Conrad about that major development last week that places New York on the cusp of being the first state in the country to outlaw the feline declaw procedure. Dr. Conrad and the organization she founded, the Paw Project, played a pivotal behind-the-scenes role, and we'll hear about it in just a moment. This is Dr. Jennifer Conrad back on Talking Animals on WMNF. Good morning, Dr. Conrad.
Morning, Duncan. How are you?
Good. Thanks for joining us again on Talking Animals. So tell us kind of how, just at least in broad outline, how this got done. This is pretty cool, momentous, and congratulations.
Oh, well, thank you. It's taken a lot of time. It's what it takes to do legislation is it takes teaching a lot of legislators why the issue is important, making sure that they won't allow any exceptions, because exceptions would swallow the rule, and correct timing. And then we had Linda Rosenthal, who's the assembly member, who pushed it through in New York. We're very excited about this.
So what is it? I mean, I'm still waiting, as I understand it, Governor Cuomo's signature.
It's true. We have to wait for his signature to sign it into law, but we're very hopeful that he will follow through with this resounding, the number of people who voted yes on this is resounding, so I'm hoping that he'll follow through and sign the bill into law and protect all of New York's cats.
And has he signaled anything other than that he will indeed sign it and hopefully fairly promptly versus some delay?
Well, from his office, we've only heard that he'll look at it. But we are hopeful that he will sign it because he understands how important it is.
Yeah. Okay. So with that in mind, there's probably no particular timetable for when that signature will happen.
We're all sitting in anticipation, believe me.
I'm sure. So, and let's just back up, even though, I was looking back yesterday, Dr. Conrad, and saw that I think our very first conversation on the air about this was in 2005. But just for people who might be listening today who may not really understand what we're talking about when we talk about feline declaw surgery, maybe you could just give a quick explanation.
Well, declawing is actually better named denuckling because it requires taking the bones from a cat's toes. Remember, our nails grow from skin, but cat claws actually grow from the bone. So in order to remove the claw, you actually have to remove the bone.
Ugh. So, yeah, so basically I think as we've discussed over the years, you're effectively amputating at the first knuckle across that cat's paws.
Exactly. It's 10 amputations in the front, and because cats only have 8 toes in the back, it's 8 in the back.
Okay. So, anyway, so the point is, for people who are maybe just hearing this for the first time, and frankly, I'm hearing it for the umpteenth time, and it still kind of gives me a bit of a sick feeling. But, so that's what the legislation that's now pending in New York is designed to prevent, and I know, I think one of the last times we did talk on the show, there's some other states that obviously aren't as far along as New York is, but are in kind of that sort of preliminary stage. What are some of those states?
Well, New Jersey and Massachusetts are next, we're hoping this year. We already lost miserably in California because we have an enemy in the California Veterinary Medical Association, which will not budge on the issue. They are sure that it should just be a decision between an owner and a veterinarian. But what I have to say is the reason it has to be legislated is because veterinarians have failed to police themselves on this issue. And I am a veterinarian, as you know.
Yeah.
25% of American cats are being declawed, whereas the surgery is listed as supposedly a last resort, like after you've tried all the humane options, you go to declawing. But how is that possible? It's 25% of American cats are being declawed. And most of those cats are declawed before they are 8 months old. So it really isn't a last resort. Veterinarians have failed to police themselves, and that's why it has to be, the government has to step in.
And something else along those lines, Dr. Conrad, and probably help partially accounting for that percentage, is that my understanding, at least, is that a lot of vets and other places you would go when you first maybe adopt a kitten or a cat, and you're going to get the spay neuter and other things chipped, whatever, that often is part of like a package deal, and I'm furiously making air quotes, that declaw sometimes is included in what would otherwise be kind of the fundamental things that you would want to get for your cat.
Right. I think that a lot of new adopters, they're unsuspecting when they go to their veterinarians and they see this package that includes declawing, and the veterinarian says, well, it's better if you declaw when they're babies because it's easier on the cat, and also it means only one anesthesia. But most people don't realize that they're actually subjecting their cat to possibly a lifetime full of pain, because amputation always causes pain. And as we know in humans, there is the idea of phantom pain, that people describe that they feel pain in the limb even though it's amputated. And I'm sure that cats probably feel that too, 10 times.
Yeah, well, that's part of the problem, I think, for a lot of the cats, and a lot of the things that then go wrong afterwards is they are experiencing phantom pain, and then you get into the problems with the litter box and other stuff. So anyway, Dr. Conrad, I mentioned earlier in the show that if you've followed this issue for a while, as I have, we have, listeners of the show have, you know that really nothing of consequence gets done legislatively to ban declaw surgery without you, Dr. Conrad, and the Paw Project. So can you give us a little more insights about, like, for example, working with Assemblywoman Rosenthal, or just generally maybe in some of these other states where there seems to be encouraging signs, what you and what the Paw Project more collectively do to kind of help push this along?
Well, the Paw Project is all veterinarians, and what we do is we say we are bucking the status quo, but it's because it's wrong. And just like physicians at one point decided that it's wrong to remove everybody's tonsils, and as veterinary medicine evolves, we say now that we know better, we do better. And there's ample evidence that declawing causes a lifetime of problems for cats. They come home from the surgery, they go to use the litter box, they dig in the sand, it hurts, they'll never use it again. They realize that they don't have their claws, so they begin to bite to protect themselves. These are big problems that cause the cats to lose their homes. I think legislators, when they're educated on the subject, they cannot believe that this is something that's standard in veterinary medicine.
Yeah, well, and that's, I think, why it's just so important to keep talking about it and articles on shows like this, whatever, because until such time that people do hear what's really involved, as we already covered, declaw sounds at first glance pretty innocuous. So you just don't know, hey, they're actually cutting off parts of the cat's fingers, essentially. And in the same way, just how commonplace it can be, or how, if you didn't know what it meant and how kind of dire the consequences were, that you could just go in and say, well, that's a great package for this new kitten that we just adopted. Why not? And so we just have to kind of keep working on it on that front. But so when you say it took a lot of time to get the New York ban pushed through, just pending Governor Cuomo's signature, like, how much time are we talking about? Or is there any way to quantify your efforts? I know they're sort of endless and often underappreciated, but what does that look like, if you could kind of describe it more specifically?
Well, we've met with Assembly Member Rosenthal in 2014, so it took 5 years in that sense. But it takes hours and hours and hours of making sure that every legislator has his or her questions answered, so that when it comes to a vote, they understand that it's not a good idea to allow, for instance, we had legislators who would say, well, what about if there's a very, very thin-skinned old person who loves his or her cat and is on Coumadin? Aren't you afraid of that cat scratching that person? And the answer is, well, we understand that the cat could scratch the person, but the alternative is if you decal the cat is going to bite that person. And there are thin-skinned people on Coumadin or living with HIV in the rest of the world where they don't declaw cats and somehow they manage. So we don't want to allow those exceptions that would swallow the rule.
Yeah. All right. Well, Dr. Kahn, I'm afraid we are out of time. But again, thank you so much for all your help and getting this New York ban pushed through and all your help for over many, many years. And we'll just keep talking about it. And thanks for joining us again on Talking Animals.
Thanks, Duncan.
Thank you. This is Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa, NPR News next, and then Rob Lowe.